Set down your sleepy water and your Mr. Whistle. Take off that raincoat and grab a cold beer. It's time to have a real talk about pediatric dentistry. You're listening to Bruise and Tiny Teeth, the unfiltered pediatric dentistry podcast.
Guys, what's going on? It's Casey Getz, host of the Bruise and Tiny Teeth podcast. I have a legend, an absolute legend on the podcast today, Howard Ferrand, somebody who has made a huge impact in the world of dentistry. Obviously, he's not a pediatric dentist, but he has made just a profound impact from his speaking to dentistry. Uncensored, his podcast, he's started Dental Town. He's just a crazy cool guy, very successful dude, and he's a guy I've listened to for a long time. And I've been trying to get him on the podcast for probably 2 years, but just about since I started doing it, I've been sending him emails and I finally was able to connect with him. So I was really excited for that. I did want to do one last plug here, just in case anybody wasn't aware. I did start a Facebook page for the podcast. It's not anything crazy, but I was hoping to kind of transition to getting some listeners at least following the page on Facebook. So if you pull up Facebook, hit me up, Bruise and Tiny Teeth, the unfiltered pediatric dentistry podcast. You'll find it on Facebook. I put a post up every week or two, just kind of giving an update of future guests that I have on and ideas for upcoming episodes and all that good stuff. So find me on there. But otherwise, I hope you guys enjoy today's episode as much as I enjoyed recording it. And let me know if you guys have any idea for content or if you want to hear anything particular going forward. And enjoy the episode. Thanks, guys.
Well, Mr. Howard Ferrand, it's an honor to have you on. You know, on my podcast is pretty informal. I'm not one for big fancy introductions. I'm more of a just kind of roll with it and kick it off. So I was just going to tell you that it's been a bucket list thing of mine to have you on the podcast for a long time, since the days when I was in dental school listening to lectures when I should have been paying attention, you know, in some biochemical pathway, and instead I was on Dental Town. So I'm excited to have you on, and I'd like to think everybody listening probably knows who you are, unless they've been living under a rock for the last 20 years. So your reputation precedes you. Without giving you too big of a head, I just was going to instead kick the podcast off with the cheers, and I appreciate you coming on and chat with me.
I wish I would have brought me a Blue Moon, but so you enjoy the beer, and I'll drink one afterwards in your name.
Hey, that's fantastic. Yeah, I was saying, you know, you've made it when, you know, when you're a practice owner and you own a dental office, that's a perks to owning the place. I was telling another dentist, like, perks to owning a practice: you make more money, you have autonomy to do things the way you want to do it. You have better, you know, tax write-offs. You can build equity in the practice. You have retirement planning. And then I could add number six, that when you own the place, you can drink beer after a long day of seeing patients and nobody can tell you shit. And it's awesome. Yeah. Can't do that at Heartland Dental, but perks of ownership. Well, anyways, Howard. So, yeah, thank you again for coming on. I guess maybe you can kick us off by, I would like to think everybody listening knows who you are, but just on the off chance, we caught a new grad on here who doesn't know much about you. I know that you're not pumping out podcasts like you used to, and I hope you're enjoying the slowdown a little bit after a long career. But you want to tell people a little bit about your background and who you are, and a summarized version of all the crazy things you've done in your professional career?
Well, I'm 60 years old. I was born in 62 in Wichita, Kansas. My mom and dad were underage Catholics. They got married, had like seven kids in a weekend. And my dad delivered rainbow bread for $11,000 a year. And we were so damn poor, we didn't even know we were poor. And then he saved up his money. Isn't that amazing? Only making $11,000 a year, he could save money. And he saved up my whole life, 10 years, and bought a Sonic drive-in franchise. That was the new big thing back then. After World War II, Eisenhower built all the freeways and interstates, and that was the infrastructure for franchises. And so franchises were born, and he liked the Sonic drive-in. And the first year, he made $60,000, and we just had baller money. And then he opened up one every year. By the time he had five open, we moved to the nicest area in Wichita, Kansas, Hidden Lakes Estates. And my next door neighbor was Kenny Anderson, the valedictorian of his Creighton Dental School class. Just loved him to death. So I'd rather go. So I'd either go to work with my dad and make cheeseburgers, french fries, and onion rings, or I go to work with Kenny and he'd take x-rays of teeth and do root canals and had his own lab man making gold crowns. So I wrote my dental school a letter in the seventh grade asking him, how do I become a dentist? And they told me to go to high school and take science classes. And I never gave up on dentistry. But when I got out of dentistry, you know, my dad, I had five sisters and the oldest two became nuns. They never wanted to go to any of his business, to the franchise stuff. So I was the only boy and that I could go with dad to all the conventions. I mean, I got to meet Ray Kroc, gosh darn, the founders of, Pizza Hut and Godfathers, and made great relationship with Dan Klein, the founder of Pizza Hut, and his wife, Beverly, the late wife, Beverly. And I love that whole game. So when I was a senior in dental school, I started doing demographics. And, Wichita, the population hadn't changed forever, because every time a girl gets pregnant, a guy leaves town. And, you know, these populations were fixed, but they kept getting 25, 50 new dentists every year. And the dentists were all showing me their income was going down, their new patients going down. And so I wrote the Department of Economic Security in D.C. They said the next 20 years, the United States would create 30 million new jobs, and half of them would be in L.A., Silicon Valley, Phoenix, Boston, and Tampa. And seriously, growing up in Kansas, I thought everybody in California was a nut job. I didn't want winters in Boston. I hated insects in Florida. So I went to Phoenix and did the demographics again. This is before computers. And I got a 6-foot by 4-foot board. And I traced out the 303 census tracts. I put a black pen where every dentist was, white for endodontist, yellow for orthodontist, all that stuff. And I found that in downtown Phoenix, there was a dentist for every 500 people. But way out on the edge of the suburb, it was only 1 in 7,000. And then later I found out there's all these small towns in Arizona that didn't even have a dentist. So demographics matter. And right now you got Health and Human Services that are always tracking the doctor supply shortages everywhere. And I opened up Arizona and they're spot on. I mean, every town that doesn't have a dentist or is severely underserved is shown right on the map. And, you know, and I've lived out here since 87. They're spot on. But, you know, these dentists, it's so weird because you meet them all the time where like their parents migrated all the way from Pakistan to give their children a better chance. And then their children won't go 30 miles out of town of Phoenix and go to some city that doesn't have a dentist. They got to go right downtown to Scottsdale. You know, mom went 15,000 miles and now her daughter won't go 50 miles to Eloy. And you just got to follow the demographics. And then the owner operators, I mean, they're the ones who have who take all the risk because they got skin in the game. And so the owner operators, they filter out all the cream of the crop. That's why the DSOs get what they have. Because anybody that had ambition isn't sitting in there doing fillings and cleanings for 5 years out of school for a DSO salary. They're all like you and me, who owner operator got their own place. And same thing with referrals. These people go work for a DSO, and they went to dental school just to know that they should for all the reasons they should refer this root canal or this. I mean, they don't do anything. But, I mean, but when you're an owner operator, I mean, you got to be living on the edge. I mean, when you're first 5-10 years out of school, if you don't look at tomorrow's schedule before you go home and something doesn't make your stomach like, maybe I should, you know, stay here and set up, make sure I got the healing cap and the bone grab, you know, I mean, if there's not stuff that's making you not want to eat your dinner on the next day, you're in the lazy zone. And, you know, obviously you don't come out of school and try to do an all on four. But if you can't take a toothache and turn it into a root canal, billet, and crown, or extract it and bone graft it and place the implant in the crown, I don't know. You're not going to pay back $500,000 student loans. And then these kids, and I can vouch for this, I can find you 100 dentists in Phoenix that will vouch for this. We have two dental schools. We have AT Still in Mesa. We have Midwestern up in Glendale, Arizona. They come out of school $500,000 in debt. And they tell every dentist, well, I didn't go to dental school to work evenings and weekends. It's like, what? And then they got a $500,000 of student loans. That's a house payment. And then they go buy a house that costs more than their student loans. And they go buy a $600,000 or $700,000 house. Dude, if you got a $500,000 mortgage, that's for student loans, that's your house payment. You don't deserve a house. You don't get a house. You go live in Section 8 housing and get food stamps. And I'm not even kidding on this stuff. You qualify for food stamps of that. And then if you're going to spend $500,000 or $600,000, it's not on a house. It's on a practice. I mean, it's one thing to put debt into a business or stocks or bonds. It's another thing to take debt and go on vacation and buy a big old house and houses or money pits. So, and that $500,000 student loans, I'll tell you, I got to attack that too. I go to these dental schools. Their parking lot looks like it's a BMW Lexus dealership. They're buying $75,000 to $85,000 cars on student loans. The Mormons are deciding, well, hell, I'll just have a stay-at-home wife. And already they already have one kid walking and one in the oven before they graduate. And then when they come out of school, I say, you know, your mom and dad would love it if you live with them. You got to get a kid. She's pregnant. You don't have a dime. Go move in with your mom and dad. Oh, no. Oh, no. They go buy a $700,000 house in Gilbert. So now they're $500,000 student loans because they're living high on the hog and had kids in school. Then they go buy a $700,000 house. And then some of them decide that they're in so much debt, they just better play it safe and go work at Heartland or Aspen or whatever. I mean, they're just completely backwards, man. You got to come out of school and hustle, hustle, hustle. I say get a department. I'm glad you got a dental degree. I mean, there's no one, walk up to anybody at a grocery store. I do this all the time. I was with three dental students yesterday, and I just, first lady I saw, how much money would I have to give? And she was like 65 or something, to pull your front tooth and you can never replace it. She just laughed. She goes, I wouldn't do that for $1 million. Oh, no, I thought they were knocking the door. But they wouldn't do it for $1 million. Dentistry isn't going away. It's always going to be here. People need the beauty. I mean, just I know a girl who lost her four front teeth. She can't even take her flipper out in front of her husband. He's never seen her without her flipper in there. And she has no problems with it. She thinks it's beautiful. That's why she's kept it so long, because, you know, it just looks great. But she wants the implants done. But the whole thing's got to be done without him ever seeing it. I mean, beauty, you got to be as pretty as a peacock. Remember, the number one goal of every species is to reproduce and have offspring. And dentistry has a lot more to do with looking brighter, whiter, and sexier and attracting a mate and having offspring. And that's the other thing, Invisalign. I mean, how do these dentists come out of school, $500,000 student loans, when that dental school knows that half the towns in the United States of America do not have one of the 12 dental specialties? There's no orthodontist, oral surgeon, an endodontist in Eloy to Beeville. They're not there. So these kids come out of school and they can't even do a molar root canal. They can't even do Invisalign. Half the planet wants straighter, whiter, brighter, sexier teeth. And now my generation, it was only the ugliest kid got braces, the one that no one would ever marry. He could eat corn on the cob through a chain link fence. You know, he'd have to be a priest or a nun, you know, no, totally non. They'd fix that kid up. Now with birth control, only two kids a family, they all get braces in their teens. They get them again in their 30s. They get them again when they're divorced in their 40s or 50s and going back on the market. So you got to learn clear aligners. Now, you're a pediatric dentist. The thing I got to point out to you guys is that, you know, every time you go to a pediatric dentist, the mom's going to say, well, do you think you need braces? And then you write a referral card that he's got to make another appointment, go somewhere else. And now I see the 1 + 1 = 3. I see every time a pediatric dentist and an orthodontist, usually two girls, open up, they just explode. Because yep. It's just the right hand, left hand. Oh, you need braces. Why don't you have, you know, the orthodontist assistant come in afterwards and take a peek, or the orthodontist, whatever. So it's all about doing things faster, easier. Just like when I was little and went to grandma's house in Parsons, Kansas, the meat man did the meat, and then they had a bread man, and you had a vet. You didn't have the grocery store that had every department inside a big Walmart. I mean, we went to the bread man. We went to the meat man. We went to four or five stores to buy stuff for dinner. So pediatric dentistry and orthodontist, I think that goes hand in hand.
Yeah. And you know, Howard, I thought maybe we didn't get a chance to talk a ton before we got going, but you kind of played kind of an integral role in my startup process. And I was going to, if you don't mind, I was going to give you the backstory on like my practice, because I think there's a few things that you might point out that I think some of the listeners would benefit from. But, you know, I didn't come from a dental background or like didn't have a dad or a mom that was a dentist or anything, but I worked at an engine shop in college. So I worked full time, paying for beer and gas money, you know, fixing engines, wrenching on stuff. And one of the summers, a pediatric dentist comes in, pays for like a $10,000 mower with cash. And he asked what I was going to school for, said I didn't really know. He said he was a pediatric dentist, that I should come shadow his practice. I said, that sounds pretty cool. So went and checked it out. It was kind of my vibe. I said, this is what I want to do. So I applied, got into Iowa. I did my dental school at Iowa, matched for residency, became pediatric dentist. And then I got out and associated for about 8 months before COVID hit, and then got laid off with all the COVID stuff. And I kind of knew that I was interested in owning my own practice kind of in, you know, rural Iowa or Missouri, but that was kind of the spark to kick it off because I had all this free time. So I, in that time period, I binged your 30-day dental MBA. And even though that was, I don't know, I was probably about your boy's age when that was recorded. The advice is timeless. The fashion is maybe not so much with the khaki pants and the and the glasses. But anyways, that your 30-day dental MBA was really helpful from like a macroeconomic perspective. And so I binged that. I created my own logo, hired the staff, got the loan, built the office, and then I moved to a small town here in Northeast Missouri where I'm the only pediatric dentist for like about 100 miles in 3 out of the 4 directions. And I think we're on year 3 now. And first year we collected like 985 and then 1.5. And this year's 2 point something. And it's all just by myself. I'd see a bajillion kids, you know, I'm booked out till, you know, it's 6 months out, but it's just, there's every time I fix a cavity, like 3 more pop up. So it's just a lot of the principles that you've said on repeat over and over and over, you know, I applied. And it, like you say, demographics are everything. And people just don't put enough emphasis on, you know, you can live in the suburbs. My wife works at a big hospital downtown and I just drive the opposite direction. And the people are nicer out here. They just say, how do I fix these teeth? I just say, let's just put crowns on and put the kid to sleep, fix them all, whatever. The overhead's super low because I'm out in Farmville and I don't have a Starbucks to go to, but I love my practice. And that's my long-winded way of giving you my backstory. But I appreciate some of the insight that you've given to guys like me that were fired up to do startups and own practices right out of dental school, because a lot of it's really timeless advice.
Well, man, you did everything right. You did everything right. Congratulations, man. And America is a big country and half the country lives in just a few small little areas and these big rural areas. I know two practices right now where after the guy had listed for sale for 3 years, they just walked away from him and closed them down. Mm-hmm. I mean, so a dental office where they could have made bank just closed. No one even looked at it. Mm-hmm. They all want to live in downtown Phoenix where the metro is a 4 million. No one will go to Eloy.
Mm-hmm. Did Howard Beck, you know, I know I'm aware that I don't believe you practice, you know, clinical dentistry or pick up a handpiece regularly anymore. But back when you were, you know, full steam working all the time, did you see a lot of kids back in the day when you were practicing?
I did. I saw a lot of kids. Wasn't a big fan of kids. I mean, I always tried to send them to a pediatric dentist, but I was lucky. I was in Phoenix. You know, we had John, you know, we had a pediatric dentist, you know, in the parking lot, you know, Jungle Roots Dentistry. So, yeah, you're lucky in Phoenix. I mean, I never really cared about medical emergencies because the fire department was literally one block down the street. I mean, we called the fire department twice. Once the receptionist called because someone was choking. And then once she called, I think on herself, she thought she was going to faint. But I mean, they're just there the minute you call. It's so different, you know, that's a big advantage. But yeah, I even though I love my 4 kids and my 8 grandkids are the greatest thing ever, I never really got relaxed in pediatric dentistry. Seems like whenever I was doing pediatric dentistry, my pulse would go up real high and I would listen to my body and I would just say, man, I just don't like it. But I could almost fall asleep doing a molar root canal, you know, or pulling a wisdom tooth. So, yeah, you know, some procedures. And it's like with your kids, you know, I took my granddaughter, I couldn't believe it. You know, she didn't like anything I took her to, nothing. And took her to soccer and she loves soccer. And, you know, everything else, no interest. So, you know, if you're doing dentistry and, you know, to me, it just wasn't worth the money. I was just always stressed. I mean, that kid and then the mom's jumping in there and you're just like, yeah, I just wanted it to stop.
Yeah. Well, you've talked to thousands of dentists and Lord knows how many countries have you lectured in at this point in your career?
Oh, like 50.
Yeah, it's crazy. So yeah. Like, I'd be curious, you know, as a GP that's talked to a lot of, you know, pediatric dentists, how have you seen pediatric dentistry change? You know, you're kind of from that era where it was very like pediatric dentistry was a lot of old white guys that were very hand over mouth and rubber dams and, you know, amalgams on everything, very traditional dentistry. And dentistry, arguably amongst all the specialties, seems like it's changed, or it's undergoing this really radical change where it's very female dominated, super conservative, lots of SDF, Hall crowns, you know, glass ionomer use. But, you know, it seems like it's a much more competitive specialty. But I'm just curious, how, in your eyes, how has pediatric dentistry changed? And is that a direction that you think is a good thing for the marketplace? Or are you a fan of kind of old school, conservative, comprehensive dentistry?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. My claim to fame in pediatric dentists is when I lectured in Hong Kong, I actually met the first pediatric dentist in Hong Kong. Same story in New Delhi back in the late early 90s. And in Hong Kong, you know, they didn't have decay. I mean, in China, they didn't have decay. Everything was traditional. And then they went to that one child, one family rule. And now, so this kid has two parents and everything goes to him. And then he's got four grandparents and they're always trying to buy him treats or this and that. And they start getting all these cavities, and the parents and the grandparents didn't even recognize it because that's not part of their culture. They don't have bad teeth. They don't eat sugar. And then all of a sudden the decay is going crazy. Same thing. This pediatric dentist told me that, you know, he has to go out and hit all the study clubs, all he can, because when these kids start peeing in bed, the same thing with diabetes, their parents start spanking them. And they think it's a discipline issue. The little Johnny's peeing his bed at night. So pediatric dentistry has changed in the fact that I watched sugar consumption drop, you know, just skyrocket in China. By the way, when I went to China, every dentist I talk to, just like if I talk to a dentist here, I'll say, name the three dynasties of China. They wouldn't know. If I said, who's the president? Maybe now with social media, they know Xi, but they couldn't name every president, some Mao Zedong or Jiang Xiaoping or any of these people like that. But almost every dentist I talked to over 30 years, I'd say, well, can you name our president? And they'd almost always say no. I mean, 90, there are 1,400,000,000 people. Why would you need to pay attention to another country? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I would ask every dentist, because they're highly educated in every society, I said, well, what do you think about the United States? What comes to your mind? And all they do is name things you eat. They'd say Hershey's chocolate bar, Coca-Cola, Dr. Pepper, KFC. I mean, just things you can eat. So I would say that the major takeaway I've seen in pediatric dentistry is decay off the charts. The second thing I've noticed about it is the old sugar model where, you know, you're just eating more sugar. It's a herd disease. And I learned in my practice that when I saw a two-year-old that needed a chrome steel crown, somebody's kissing that baby with a bombed out molar. And I really could, it was real practice builders, because I would sit there and say, I need to see every single person that's sharing a spoon or kissing on this baby. I mean, every one of them, grandma, grandpa, babysitter, no two-year-old horse could have this disease unless it was rampant in the barn. There's no milk cow at a dairy farm that could have this disease if every milk cow didn't have it. Somebody's got a bum. Someone's kissing this kid with a bombed out molar, gingivitis, gum, and they're all like, oh, I bet it's grandpa. I said, I don't know if it's the babysitter or the maid, but if anybody's in that house putting a spoon in their mouth or kissing this baby, I need to see him, because Why? What am I going to do? You want me to do a root canal and a crown on this baby tooth? I want to know who kissed that into that baby's mouth, and I could get the whole family in there. And then, sure enough, you'd always try to be grandma with like a bombed out number two that would just mush, and I would clean up the whole herd. And that baby, they'll do anything for a baby. Like, go to funerals. When grandpa dies, no one sheds a tear. They're like, he's a good man, you know, high five, a sneaker. You know, when grandma dies, there's some tears. But man, when a baby dies, oh my God. It's ugly. It's in fact, it's the only two times in my life I've seen stammering. That's that behavior where you're so in grief that you just start kicking, you start slamming your foot forward. It's called stammering. And when a woman is stammering, I mean, she's just about to lose her complete mind. I mean, it's just horrible. So that kid's in there, and you say, look, you send out a text to everyone, man. You got a two-year-old that needs a root canal and a crown. That's an infection. Now, what if she had gonorrhea? Do you think it came from a tree? What if she had HIV? Do you think that came from, you know, a doorknob? No, this disease came from another human who's eating with her, sharing utensils and kissing and licking and getting saliva on her. And I don't even want to do this root canal and crown her until I've seen everybody in the house. They'd all line up. Mm-hmm. They get them all in there, and they say, well, my grandpa, you don't want to come in. Say, that's fine, but he's not ever going to be in the same house as this baby until you, I mean, come on, man, your baby needs a 2-year. If you took a 2-year-old and just started feeding it Dr. Pepper 24 hours a day, it's not going to form a cavity. It's like in the backyard. If I just put out a bunch of giraffe food, would a giraffe just show up? I said, if there's a giraffe in your backyard or a polar bear, I mean, do you know enough about biology to know that that polar bear had to come from a mama and a daddy polar bear? Polar bears just don't show up in your backyard because you're throwing out Dr. Pepper and ding dongs and ha-hos. That polar bear came from, it's a life form. And this thing eating your tooth, somebody kissed, licked, and shoved a spoon in their mouth. And I need, so treating it as a herd disease was a big practice builder. I thought it really dropped the DMFT road. It got everybody on board. I had people come in here and say, is this where I'm supposed to go? And they're like, what? Is this where I'm supposed to go? Oh, Megan, I guess Megan, her child needs a root canal, and they wanted everybody in the family to come here. I guess they got to check all of her teeth because they think she caught it from one of us. And I mean, I got that herd mentality in. And yeah. and then the other thing is, you know, it's like the orthopedo. I mean, Alan Longfellow was a pediatric dentist up the street from here, and he got all into ortho. I mean, he was a pediatric dentist, but he did all the ortho stuff, and he did all of his own pediatric dentistry and ortho. So I would tell pediatric dentists that, you know, I mean, there's general dentists that do all their Invisalign, do all their ortho. And I know a lot of that's all controversial because you couldn't get all the dentists to agree on what day it is. Let alone how to do clinical dentistry. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love that about dentistry. They're so passionate, but they're like you take silver, diamine, fluoride. I mean, that issue is a nuclear war on dental town.
Yes, it is.
I mean, it's like good versus evil. I mean, it's like communism versus democracy. I mean, it's crazy. But the bottom line, I love it. The passion that dentists have with their viewpoints. But all I'm telling you is just keep it consumer focused, man. Why can't you learn ortho? I mean, why can't you go take Richard Litt's course for us? Why can't you take Eric? Why can't you learn how to at least answer the damn orthodontic question? Does my child need braces? And if you can't answer that without a pano and a SAF or whatever the heck you do, but I think pairing up with an orthodontist would be great. Now, I don't like partnerships. I hate, like, you own your own office. I would walk to China 3 times if that's what it took to convince you to never a partner, you know.
Okay.
Never become a partner with someone unless you have great sex with them and you just want to keep having great sex with them. You know what I mean? If you're not having sex with your partner, that's very, very wrong. I mean, just own the thing. But yeah, I mean, I know Dennis. I know one of my best friends. He sold a partnership for a dentist for $600,000. It wasn't working out. It cost $700,000 in legal fees. Then he lost and had to give her $600,000 back. And that was 3 years of agony. You know, when you're divorcing your wife's at home or she's working in the hospital, whatever. No, you're divorcing the other person in your office. Mm-hmm. And you're working together for years. I mean, it's so stupid. I mean, just don't do it, man. Just you're the owner. You're the dictator. It's an authoritarian dictatorship. And that's why you can do it your way. And the value and the price of the peace of mind is that there's no money in China to compensate for the fact that now every little decision, you got to get it approved by your partner.
Mm-hmm. I was going to make a comment. You're talking about consumer focused dentistry. One of the kind of nuggets I took home from your 30-day dental MBA back in the day was something I implemented here. But you talked about, I don't know if you remember this, but you talked about how dentists are tight asses with like the reward system with kids a lot of time. You know, a mom comes in and spends $1,500 putting a couple of stainless steel crowns on a tooth, and then you give the kid a 50 cent, you know, sticky hand or a bouncy ball or something. So this was an idea I took from you that's been really popular, where on the last day, a kid gets all their cavities fixed. If they're a good kid, they show up, they're like relatively cooperative. You get a bunch of cavities done. You're like, all right, bud, you can't tell anybody, but if we get all those cavities fixed today, you get to pick out of your top secret, like super secret prize box. And their eyes light up and they get all jacked up about it. And then I've got a big box of like $10 prizes under the front desk. It's got action figures and, you know, Nerf guns and Legos and stuff. And those kids think it's like the coolest thing ever. And that was an idea I give you a shout out for, is like, you know, I think pediatric dentists get so caught up in seeing 60 kids a day and get busy that they forget to take time to like reward the kid. I try to be good about like complimenting parents, you know, like, oh my God, you have the cutest daughter. Like, we get so busy, we forget to like keep it patient and parent centered, that we're offering a service, and it's important to prop that ego up a little bit. But those are a couple of good like pearls I took home from your pediatric lecture in that course.
Oh, that's awesome, man. But it's true. They never remember your credentials. They never remember they needed to get a chrome still ground. They only remember how you made them feel. Mm-hmm. And like I say, I can spot a dentist netting $500,000 a year within 10 seconds of walking in the office, because everybody's fun. Everybody's talking. They're teasing the dentist, you know, and then you go to the other office. No, I just like, well, I'm not allowed to diagnose, you know. Do you think this need to work it out? Well, I'm not allowed to diagnose. What is this, a creepy law firm? I mean, my God. I mean, she's been your hygienist for 10 years, and she can't make a random educated guess whether this tooth's going to need a root canal? I mean, obviously, she's not the dentist. I mean, the ones that are having fun, and the parents, the trust with the parents is so easy with the parents. They know what you're doing is invisible. They know that they don't know what you're doing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And when you're selling the invisible, they always grade you on staff turnover. And man, when every time they walk in there, you got a different dental assistant, they start thinking something's wrong with you. In fact, the biggest practice builder I ever did was keeping my trusty assistant Jan there for 30 years. And I can't tell you how many moms would have a question. They'd call in and they say, well, Dr. Friend's, he's actually free, standing right here. You want to talk to Dr. Friend? No, just have Jan call me when she's got a minute. I mean, they didn't even want to talk to the doctor with 8 years of college and FAGD, MA. They didn't give a GD. They loved and trusted Jan. And, you know, the new hygienist should be, you know, 9 years. And that's why the DSOs don't have a chance, man. They're average. I think Heartland's keeping them for 2, but the average DSO is keeping them for 1 year. And man, when you're in Phoenix, man, the DSOs, it's like shooting fish out of a barrel, because they come in there and they go, well, you know, the doctor said I had 5 cavities. So I scheduled to go in to have 3 of them done, and that doctor's no longer there. So another doctor, he was going to do them, but he said, I actually have 6 cavities. So then he did 3 of them. I mean, it's just like, it's a zoo. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't keep the, and that's why you need to hire slow and fire fast. And you only get rid on toxic. When you're in there doing a root canal, or you're not up at the front desk, I mean, 3 strikes and you're out, man. Like, when patients don't come back, I'd always call them up to the next year and be like, Casey, you know, you never came back, and you know, you had 3 cavities. I just wondering, did you move? Did you lose your insurance? Or did you have a problem with me or the staff? And then you start hearing these, all of the above, but you start hearing the staff go, well, I just think so. I mean, that, I swear to God, I swear, Howard, if she wasn't working here, if she would have said that in the parking lot, I would have slapped her. And it's like, whoa. So then I go back and tell her this and that. And then other staff are saying, dude, I'm telling you, she's toxic bitch. And then, you know, and finally, when you realize, and what's really weird is it's always the dentist's favorite, because she knows to bring you a Starbucks and always smile at you. And then you close your office door and you're back there in the door. And then she's at the sterilization machine being toxic again. And you don't want any toxicity, because the staff picks it all up. And then they have staff turnover. The patients pick it all up. Something's wrong in that office, this and that. And once you have no toxicity and everyone's having fun, and they can tease the big guy, they can tease the general, you know what I mean? And, you know, they're all playing. The staff, the patients feel it, they trust it, and they stay there and they refer their friends. And once they don't feel it, once they don't feel the love, once they hear the little sniping at each other between the assistant and the hygienist, and like I say, the dentists are so aloof to this stuff. You have to have a smell for toxicity. And you can be really nice 4 days in a row, but you walk in the 5th day and you're mad and you tell your assistant, you know, she's a bitch. I mean, they only remember the bad stuff. Mm-hmm. And some people are so toxic, so moody, so all over, and you just got to make it all fun. And then you go, and then after you do that for 30 years, it's kind of neat hearing staff say, you know, the worst time of my life was when my mom died, or when we went through a divorce. And at that time in my life, the only thing good in my life was coming to work. And I love the people and I love my job. And then I would leave my job and I'd have to go back home, back to reality of taking care of a dying mom or a divorce or whatever. And so many people, it's the opposite. The worst thing in their life is going to work in that dental office and they only got 5 employees and one of them is Attila the Hun and dumbass can't even figure it out. I mean, how do you not figure out Amy is a toxic witch? How do you not know that?
Okay. Well, how about this? I wanted to leave time because this was a new topic that I haven't heard you kind of rant about a little bit, but circling back, one of the first things you brought up was, you know, grads get out of dental school and, you know, you're a pediatric dentist, you graduate, you got $500,000 in just soul crushing student loans and you got to deal with that. And then everybody thinks the fastest way out is to get a corporate job, make $200,000 a year, and then pay it off the rest of their lives. When in reality, the answer is to do something like you and I did. Go start a practice, become an owner, hustle and grind and increase your income and pay it off. But I was curious on your thoughts. You know, we've been, and that's basically what I did. You know, I paid, knocked out all the student loans as soon as I became an owner, which was really nice. But deferral, all this federal student loan deferral, that's coming up where the parties, you know, music's about to stop, if you will, and people are going to start having interest accrue again. They're going to start have to make all these student loan payments. But I heard a statistic that only I wrote down 1% of all federal student loan borrowers actually made payments during that whole almost 3-year stretch of not having any payments at all. And so I just picture all these dentists out here who all of a sudden don't have to make that, you know, whatever couple thousand dollar a month student loan payment. And the music's about to stop. And I kind of wonder what's that going to have for ripple effects with our economy. But I was just curious, you know, what sort of thoughts you had, you know, are we all just, was that the smart thing to do? Or are you a little bit worried about kind of the shape of our economy? Because you talk to a lot of young dentists with a lot of student loan. Do you think, is that going to be a real problem coming up when the loans come due?
Well, you know, the economy, you know, Joseph Schumer got a Nobel Prize in economics for, you know, his business cycles. I mean, the business cycle is as sure as, you know, AM and PM, the sun goes down and it comes back up. And it's because humans make a lot of imperfect decisions. And every 7 to 14 years, there's a correction. And the opposite of a correction is incorrect. You made a lot, you know, like you bought an Airbnb and started making money. So your brother thought, I need to get Airbnb and start making. And pretty soon there's more Airbnbs than there are people that want to rent an Airbnb. I like it as the Buffett indicator. The Buffett indicator was you take all the country's publicly traded companies and divide them by the GDP. And usually all the publicly traded companies are worth about 70% of the GDP. And if it ever gets all the way up to about 100, you know, it's too high and you're going to trend back down to 70. And then it went over 100. And then it went to 200. And at 200, I said, okay, I'm out of here. I'm selling at the top. I sold my houses, my dental practice, my land and building, and I'm sitting on a pile of cash because this is the fifth time I've seen this. So, I mean, when someone says, you think a recession is coming, there's never not been a recession. It's not a matter of if there's a business cycle. There's always, and if you're a recession, there's always going to be sunny days ahead. And there's sunny days ahead, there's always going to be a recession ahead because humans are not perfect animals and AI is not going to change it. But again, back to the dentist. Economics matter. It's, do you have skin in the game? And, you know, they shouldn't have graduated $500,000 student loans. They spent high on the hog. You know how many of them went out to eat every Friday and Saturday night and had drinks and sushi and went to a movie and drove at 70. I mean, so they lived high on the hog. So when they tell you that $500,000 student loans, but that's a house payment. And then they're going to go every time they buy a house, it's more than their student loan. So how are you bitching about your student loans when you bought a house that was bigger? And did your grandparents, do you ever see the first house your grandparents bought? It probably fit in your garage. And then, you know, I mean, why is their first house 3,000 square feet? I mean, it's totally insane. And you know, so the overspending, and then the worst is they're lazy. They're just lazy. Like they'll sit there. They always want to tell you about their student loans. So I always have to carry around the world's smallest guitar. I got a little deal where I take out the world's smallest guitar and just start playing, you know. Uh-huh. But the bottom line is I can name you 20 Medicaid clinics on Saturday in the south and west side of Phoenix in the poor areas where you could go get a job there on Saturdays and probably do 25 pulpotomies a day. And then I go, I don't want to go work at a Medicaid clinic. Okay, so what do you do Saturday? You're going to be off Saturday and Sunday. So what do you do Saturday? You're going to go golf at some course for $300. And then Sunday, you're going to go to Home Depot and start a bathroom remodeling project. And then you're going to get on the phone and Facebook and Instagram and bitch about how you only did two pulpotomies while in dental school and you felt like you're a victim when I just showed you could have got a job in a Medicaid clinic and did 25 pulpotomies a day. I mean, so the owner operators suck out all the great associates. Mm-hmm. So then when the guy, the owner operator wants to hire associates, all the good ones ain't going to work for you. All mm-hmm. the good ones are you, are me. And they'll do it for, I did it for 4 months while my office was being built. And then I was so lucky because he had two shifts. He had 6 to 2 and 2 to 10. So the first couple of weeks, I just dropped the 6 to 2. So I go work my office 6 to 2, 7 days a week. And then I go work for Ed Schillingberg, 2 to 10 at Sunshine Dental. He had four locations. And then after about 2 or 3 months, I started dropping the evening and it was all mine. But everyone that's going to hustle, everyone that's going to work hard, they're all going to be owner operators. They're all going to have skin in the game. And like I say, I would have no problem being in between every major DSO known to man, because since they can't keep a dentist, and that really, really irritates people a lot. I mean, they just do not like the fact that every time they go in there, it's a different dentist. It just seems shady. And mm-hmm. they're right. There mm-hmm. is a problem. Go ask all the dentists why they quit.
Yeah. I have a question related to that, actually, that I think people are going to be interested to hear your opinion on. Like, pediatric dentistry right now is really the market for the DSO buyouts is really hot, and it's hot everywhere. But pediatric dentists in particular, you know, have been getting targeted. You know, if you've got a really high dollar practice or multiple practices with big EBITDA margins, they're throwing all these big multiples. And I've been trying to do a good podcast on when these DSO buyouts go wrong, but this all just seems like it's just this inevitable cycle of mergers and acquisitions that a lot of other industries have gone through, and now dentistry is going through it. So I go back and forth where it's like, is this ultimately what's best for, you know, for our patients, where in 20 years, where all the pediatric dentists coming out are either working for some secret corporate umbrella DSO backed by investment hedge fund and overseas piles of money to invest in all these practices, and it's all corporate owned. Is that a future that we want? Is that, or is that a bad future? Or do you think there's always going to be a place for, private practice, solo docs, and maybe the correct thing to do is not to take the giant paycheck and sell your soul to corporate, and instead, you know, don't take the big payday, sell to the next, you know, hungry dental student that comes out. You know, it just, that's a big discussion right now. And I go back and forth on what's best for the future of dentistry. So I was curious, you know, where do you stand with the way that things were going with the corporatization of dentistry and pediatric dentistry and all that?
Well, that's a great question. A lot of stuff wrapped up inside there. And I'd say, first of all, and it's not just me, you know, I went to Creighton University in Omaha, and Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, he came over and lectured our business class. Charlie Munger's from Omaha. Mm-hmm. He wrote his book, the Charlie Munger's Almanac, you know, after the Farmer's Almanac, he wrote Munger's Almanac. But the bottom line is, whenever Charlie Munger says, whenever you hear someone talking and they use the word EBITDA, they're a con artist, they're a crock of shit. They really are. I mean, whenever they mention him, I mean, think about it. Earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization. I'm sorry, are those not four expenses that everybody have? Why did you say before earnings before labor, payroll, lab bill, supplies, electric bill, heater, earnings? I mean, it's just all bullshit. And then since I got a DDS and an MBA, and I'm on LinkedIn with like 40,000 followers, I'm always getting all these Wall Street boys sending me this stuff. And I see a lot of inside information. And some of these, like they take the biggest DSO that was sold in Arizona and bought by someone else. The owner didn't have one penny in there. See, we've been at zero cost money during their whole boom from 2008. None of these people had to make a profit. They were buying them. They were doing mergers and acquisitions where not only was the whole thing paid for on borrowed money, even the closing cost and everything. No one has any skin in this game. They're not profitable. I mean, to say that I would easily say that get rid of your stupid EBITDA and 2/3 of them aren't even profitable. And I'll tell you what, money is no longer free. And this next correction, you're going to see how well these DSOs are doing. And I would not, in fact, if I was in, got a score right now and I was going to buy an office, I mean, no one can predict the future. No one knows when the crash, I mean, Warren Buffett, I mean, I thought the crash would be fourth quarter in 99. And then this little virus came around. I don't know if you heard about it. It was called COVID-19. And then the government response was not to tax and collect $5 trillion and redistribute it, but just to print $5 trillion and dump it out of helicopters. So it's kept this bubble longer and longer and longer. But right now the DSOs are in trouble because now they have true cost of capital. Now you got it. You just, I mean, it used to be you could just free money, mergers and acquisitions, tie up the closing costs, pad a lot of profit and cash flow there. But man, when interest rates start hitting 6-7% and there's a correction in the stock, there's going to be a lot of DSOs. And when the tide goes out, you're going to see a lot of DSOs that are all going to be completely naked, holding a little sign that says EBITDA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, again, and I agree with you on all that. And I got in a little bit of an argument with a podcast guest previously, who was, of course, he was a broker who sells private practices and finds the highest bidder and sells them to a DSO. And it was right at the end of the conversation. But I kind of brought up, I said, is this what's actually best for our patients, you know, to be backed by all these corporate dollars? And that's kind of what, you know, even though from an economic standpoint, a lot of industries, mergers and acquisitions are a good thing because you're doing a service or making a product better, faster, cheaper, you're delivering that care better. But in dentistry, I always wonder if that doesn't apply because, you know, the more you corporatize it, the more his argument was, you know, you're going to be delivering better dentistry because you're having better technology and all these things. But I just wonder if you lose that personal touch, if it's going to become too factory-like, if you're going to have quotas to meet, if it's going to be very, just a sheer exchange of service, like you're just going to lose that personal touch. And, you know, I don't know, I'm anxious and kind of worried about what the future of our profession looks like, you know, 20 years from now, just from a patient care standpoint with the direction this is going.
Well, you know, I know I'm that guy. I'm that, you know, every 60-year-old grouchy grandpa always thinks it was better in his day, but it was. I mean, when I was little, right now, when I was little, you came out of dental school. If I was the old man and you were the young kid coming out of school and I wanted to sell my practice for a dollar, I'd say, Casey, now you got to have skin in the game. And, you got to go get half of this money. And then I'm going to carry the other half on a 10-year loan at 10%, just easy math. Mm-hmm. And now the seller's got skin in the game. It's kind of like when you give your kid up for adoption. You're not giving it up to the highest bidder. You want to know who the hell is adopting your baby and what do they plan on doing with this baby and what's the environment going to be and all that kind of stuff. And now, you know, now that it's gone from owner carry to now they just roll it all up and let someone do it at Skank of America or Bank of America, whatever they call it these days. And now that guy doesn't have a skin game. I've seen it in my own backyard where, you know, they'll sell their practice for too much money to some kid who's not qualified. They get all the money and run. And then you say, well, man, this guy, I know, but man, he had a rich dad and they came from, you know, this country and they got all the money. And it's like, no. And when you did an owner care, but think about the seller. I got this practice for a dollar. I sell to you for a dollar, but I carry. Remember, GMAC financing made $3 for every $1 GM did making the car. You always make more money in insurance, banking, and finance than you do in some machine shop making a part or a tool or assembling a car. So you sell, you have them put half down and then or at 20% down or some down, and then you carry for 10 years. Well, now that interest is worth the price of the practice and you still own land and building. So then as soon as that's paid off, now the only variable in real estate is you have an occupant and this guy's been in there 10 years and now you get to sell him the land and building. And then if you carry that for 10 years, you'll make another dollar. So now you got $4, but look at this. When the owner carries, and then you call me up and say, oh man, you know that patient, you know, Karen, she's losing her mind. He's like, I know her. I'll tell you what, have her come in tomorrow at 10 o'clock and I'll come in and adjust her denture. I'll take care of that. And then when he's at church and at Walmart and Costco, he's telling everybody, you know, my eyes and hands just weren't there anymore. And I found this young Casey and he's twice the dentist I am. I mean, if I had to go to the dentist, I'd go to Casey. So he's selling you in the community. He's covering up any crazy patients that he that he's known for a long time and can throughout that, and he's old enough to give you some advice. Say no, don't do that. You know, that's a good way to get in trouble, or this or that, or this that. And that way versus just we get it evaluated and then we're gonna finance it through Bank of America and then we close the costs. I never see you again. There's no transition. I mean, yeah, I don't like this new way at all.
So let me, as we start winding down here, maybe I'm going to put you in a situation that a lot of current pedo grads or residents are facing right now and see how you would walk through this. Cause I know you've talked to a lot of very successful dentists, a lot of multi-practice owners. I'm pretty sure you're buddies with like the founder of Heartland or something. So you've talked to a lot of really good dentists and a lot of, you know, students coming out. So if you're a recent dental school grad, you go back, you like seeing kids because you're crazy and you say, I'm gonna be a pediatric dentist, and you're in your second year of residency, you know, what's your formula for success? What do you, Howard Ferran, do if you are finishing residency, you're $500,000 in student loan, your student loans, you're engaged, you guys, in debt up to your eyeballs. Do you start working corporate? Do you go start a practice? Where do you go? How do you do it? What's your formula for success for a modern, like, pediatric dentist graduating in 2023?
Well, there's a lot of things that are out there that, you know, that you're just not allowed to talk about. You just can't talk about it. And I always do because I'm that kind of an asshole. But there's still a big difference between men and women. And even though you're a woman pediatric dentist and your husband's a male general dentist, he's still going to be a man at the house. He's still not going to help, you know, with the homework and the this and then that and all this kind of stuff like that. And I can't tell you how many women oral surgeons that I know that their husband, when they go home, they're still in that man-woman relationship where he's sitting on the couch watching ESPN and she's supposed to cook dinner. And I mean, she's got, you know, she's an MD, DDS. I mean, so a lot of women, like I could name several in my backyard where they sit there and say, I know a woman that's worked for Aspen 15 years and she loves them more than anything because she's a single mother. Mm-hmm. And now it's her kid's 13. And when she got a job at Aspen, it was a newborn baby and the husband of her got divorced and she wanted to be a mom. So she works 4 days at Aspen and that's afforded her to focus, be the mom. I know other women dentists who are married to a plumber. I mean, you want to hear the sickest thing I ever saw? There was a woman out here that had her own practice for like 15 years, baller practice. They had three girls. The girls loved their daddy. And he worked for this mid-sized company, made like $60,000 a year. And he got a management promotion, but it was in Seattle. So he said, we're all packing up going to Seattle. And she's like, okay, you missed 60 and now you're going to get 68 and you're going to be a manager. But I got a freaking 15-year-old word of mouth referral dental office. But she came over my house. She cried her guts out. And it came down to, does she want to blow up the marriage to economically show this asshole that he's an idiot? Mm-hmm. And she's got three daughters that love their dad. So she had to sell this practice and just made her just sick as a dog. And that's the reality when you're a woman married to a man. I mean, a lot of women, successful women dentists, can't even get married because nobody is going to marry a woman that makes more money than them. I mean, I would think that I would love to meet a woman that made 10 times more money than me. I mean, you know, but it's just hard to imagine. So you got love first, you got the family. So women are always getting the short end of the stick. They're always getting this type of bullshit. So overgeneralization, like saying all Irish are drunks, that's bullshit. Only 38% of us are drunks. Other 62% are just heavy drinkers. But, you know, you can't overgeneralize. I know people at DSOs that love them, and they do tend to be women. I mean, it seems like every time someone loves working for a DSO, it's always a woman. And for some reason or another, she can't go out and do it. You know, you and I are two alpha bull males. So it's kind of a dumb point of view to look out at dentistry from two alpha male point of views. There's cows and calves out there. There's people who don't have the drive of ambition. There's people who just want an 8-to-5 job. And if they might be stressed out of their mind to where they need to take medication if they had to worry about everything that you and I have to worry about. So there's a lid for every pot, but the DSOs, you got to remember, this is round two. The first round before you were out of the picture was Orthodontic Centers of America. I saw it reach it went on the New York Stock Exchange. Its valuation was $1 billion of the stock, and it crashed to zero. And then I noticed the second round, no one, I mean, look at all the junkyard companies that are publicly traded on the Wilshire 5000. I mean, there's companies like, you've got to be kidding me. That's a publicly traded company. None of them are in dentistry. They don't have the numbers to go publicly traded because they're too busy talking about EBITDA and how great they are. And if you look at the man behind the curtains, he can't go public on NASDAQ when anybody can go public on NASDAQ. How many companies have been publicly traded on NASDAQ in your lifetime that don't even make sense, but none in dentistry can because they don't have the numbers? They're only profitable on EBITDA and bullshit con artists, but they're not profitable. And the next contraction, you just haven't seen one because it was 2008, dude, this is 2023. I took geometry, so I should know how many years that is, but I don't off the top of my head. But there's going to be a correction, and I don't think half the DSOs are going to survive it, because when they do their M&A activity, no one has skin in the game. It's all borrowed, all low cost, no interest money, and that game is over. I mean, did you think at the beginning of this year that the Fed would raise interest rates 500 basis points that fast? And I'll tell you what, man, he's going to keep raising them, because I lived through this in the 70s. It started to go up, so they started to raise rates, and then it modeled off, so they lowered them, then it came back, went back up higher, and they raised rates again, and then it came back down, they lowered them, and then the inflation went all the way off the charts. And that inflation is a scary game. It scares the shit out of the Federal Reserve. And I think that it hasn't even begun yet. Everybody's saying that the core inflation is coming back down. I don't even know what numbers they're looking at. I mean, people just, they start with believing what they want to believe, and everything's just candy and frogs and happy, and you know, and it's not, dude. And you got $31 trillion of deficit. You got $2 trillion a year scheduled structural deficit, as far as the eye can see. China has never had a real estate correction one time in its life. I mean, China has something like 1 million apartment complexes completely empty. 1 million. And they're still on the books. Everybody's saying that their GDP is going to take over ours. My God, probably 15, 20% of that GDP is just lies and lies and lies. And there hasn't been a correction. And then you got, you know, you got the Russia Ukraine, which is really Russia NATO. It's really World War III. China's, you know, they want to go get Taiwan. You still got this COVID problem. You got supply chains, and more importantly, you haven't had a correction for 14 years. I mean, I've never seen this much risk on in 60 years. So, and it's not a question of if there will be a correction. That's not the question. It just, no one knows when. Every one of these, and every one of these booms is followed by a bust. Every single boom is followed by a bust, going back many. But I'm just telling you, when you see this bust, guys like you and me, you know, we'll weather the storm. But the ones on borrowed money with no equity, I mean, and there's a lot of DSOs. I mean, every DSO deal that's been showed to me by a Wall Street boy, I see one unprofitable company buying another unprofitable company because, you know, if you're a really dumb, drunk idiot, you should marry another dumb, drunk crackhead. And, you know, if a crackhead marries an alcoholic, you're going to figure it out. And, you know, look at Yellow. They just went under because, you know, they had low cost money. So they kept doing mergers and acquisitions. They kept buying up all their competitors, and Wall Street kept saying, oh, yay, look at their market share. Look at their market share. Yeah, but 3,000 of that and that Wilshire Index, 1,000 of them have never made a penny profit. I mean, the last time they made profit, they made $25 million on sales of $5 billion. Just because you can borrow a bunch of money at almost nothing and buy your competitor. Well, when you bought the competitor during the M&A, they just left them as different businesses. They didn't find any scales of economy. They didn't say, well, we only need one accounting department, one marketing department, and let's use this so that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. No, they're just buying, just like dentistry. You know, they can get the money, they can buy this chain of 10 dental offices, and now they've gone from 10 offices to 20, so they've doubled, and everybody's going, yip, yip, hee-haw, EBITDA, and no efficiencies in brand. I have no idea what they're doing. What are these 10 offices don't even do the same type of dentistry as these four. It's just, I want to be big, and since I have low-cost money, I can just borrow and just buy and just get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until I fall down. and they will, and half of them are going to fall over and you're never going to see them because round one, every one of those that made it to NASDAQ or the only servers made it to New York Stock Exchange, the rest was like a dozen on NASDAQ. Not one of those companies is alive today. And the second round, they did some things better, but one of the things they didn't do very well at all is called profitability.
You know, this is what I love about you, Howard, is I asked, you know, what would you do if you're a pediatric dentist? And we landed on Russia and Ukraine and a variety of other things, but that's that's what makes you fun. So what I tweezed out of that was you started by saying, so marry right, it sounds like pick the right partner and be cautious of DSOs. Maybe that means like look into just being your own boss or own your own practice. Like, I don't know if that's a fair short summary.
Well, if you're a woman and pediatric dentist and you're married to a man, you know, a woman pediatric dentist will always be married to a man with a degree and a job. Okay. A male pediatric dentist, two out of three of their wives will be the waitress from the Waffle House. Okay. So they always got double great professional income. But if you're a girl and your man's going to be making you do man stuff, you know, like saying you do the help and the kids and all that kind of stuff like that, they don't want that extra time of being an owner operator. And then the advice for everyone is just live below your means. Why do kids graduate from dental school and get a $700,000 house? I mean, are they a rock star? Did I miss their latest album? Did they hit a grand slam in the last World Series? I mean, do they have a Stanley Cup? Where do you get the idea that you've never had a job? You have $500,000 student loans. And you got bought a $700,000 house. Why? Because you qualified in America that will loan drunk meth addicts money for a car. I mean, the subprime is exploding. So I don't want to, I think it's insane to say that all DSOs are bad. I mean, that's just another overgeneralization. I think some are much worse. Some are much better. I think Heartland's the best one. And I can prove it just because they keep their doctors twice as long. So if you can keep my homie there for 2 years and everyone keeps there for a homie, that alone, I'll say you're twice as good. A job might be great for a passive male and a female doctor who's married to an endodontist. I mean, it's just all kinds of different games. But go rural. Go where you're needed. Go where they ain't. And live below your means. I mean, I can't believe that even those doctors that make $200,000 a year, they can't save 20 grand. It's like, man, when you were in dental school, you didn't have 200 grand a year. How do you find a way to always spend all your damn money? So you don't have to go to Starbucks every morning. I mean, if that's the case, I wouldn't even make it home. I'd just give up coffee. If you have to go to Starbucks every day, that's like meth. Just give up coffee completely. Why do you have to eat out at a restaurant? And then always tell me you want to lose 10 pounds. I mean, why can't you just go on a vacation at the lake? Why does it always have to be a cruise? Why do you have to go to Europe? Why do you have to go to Rome? I mean, I think every dentist should write down all the category spending. And I think the husband and wife should just write down, show me which categories that you live at, just the average. Because I know there's not one category where you spend below average, but can you just find one where you spend average? I mean, I bet the average dentist eats out 19 out of 30 meals. I mean, their cars, I mean, oh my God, they just, and during that last 2008, I had at least a half dozen different dentists in my front room, crying their eyes out, going over their books, trying to have salvage. There's this one dentist, he had five cars. And I thought, well, that's easy, man. We can sell some of these cars. He was leasing them all. He was leasing a Benz, a Range Rover. I mean, how small is your ding dong when you have to lease five cars? I would think if someone owned five cars, they would play for the Cardinals or the Suns or the Diamondbacks. I wouldn't think it was a pediatric dentist from Glendale. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. I mean, so just live below your means, man. Just live below your means. And if you can't save $10,000 making $100,000, then how are you going to save $20,000 a year when you're making $200,000? It's a disease. There's mm-hmm. something wrong with you. And that's why the pediatric dentists, if they open up their own practice, I mean, Phoenix, there's not one Medicaid clinic that wouldn't hire any dentist to come and see kids on Saturdays. I mean, they just, why can't you go work in a Medicaid clinic? I mean, you'll go do charity dentistry in Africa and India and you know, South America, but you won't work at a Medicaid clinic in Phoenix where you'll get some experience, you'll get some skill, you'll meet some colleagues and you'll just do a good job. I mean, those little kids were up all night crying and you only did two pole podiums at AT still, and you tell everybody that every time you meet him for 10 years, like when someone gets their Iron Man or comes out of the closet, you know, LGBT, they got to tell you they're an Iron Man or LGBT or only did two pole podiums within the first minute of meeting them, you know. It's like, well, dude, you could have done 20 pulpotomies yesterday where we need you in South Phoenix or Western Phoenix, and you won't do that because you're not working at a Medicaid clinic. I don't even know what that means when you're a doctor. Yeah. I'm not working at a Medicaid clinic. And so what are you doing Saturday? Nothing. I'm just going to cry about my student loans, and I'm going to cry about my mortgage on my $700,000 house, and I'm going to keep crying that I only did two pulpotomies at AT still, even though that, you know, it's just so hustle. I guarantee you, guys like you, you hustle, you binge watch. When you're down for COVID, you binge watch my 30 day. I mean, the thing that you and I have in common, which you can't teach at dental school, and I don't know if you're born with it or if your dad taught you. Why do you think you hustle? You think birth?
That's a great question. I don't know. I think it's, you know, when you're in dental school. So I went back and I've lectured a couple times at the University of Iowa, and I created a lecture called The Cash Flow Through a Dental Practice. So it traces a dollar from the patient's pocket through how to get their insurance info, a clearinghouse, apply it, post it. And you look up when you're done, and there's about four kids out of 80 that are actually paying attention and taking notes to what you're saying. And the rest of them are on TikTok or on Instagram. So I think it's just like some people are just programmed to, you know, want to achieve things, want to be financially independent, want to pay off their debt. I think it's just something, it's a personality trait, it seems like. It's hard to instill that in somebody that it's not innate in, it seems like.
Yeah, if the kid is intellectually curious and likes to work, likes to hustle, my God, the whole world is theirs. Mm-hmm. But if they're not curious, I remember going to Creighton one time, and some guy asked one of my roommates if he believes in afterlife, and he looked at me and he goes, you know, I've never really even thought about it. And I thought, you're going to a Catholic college and you never thought about it? I mean, there's, what, do you have a head injury? I mean, how do you make it to Creighton and never thought about it? I mean, there's ways to answer that, but never thinking about it once is not an answer. But for some reason, I mean, some people, they just hustle, and some people, they take risk. And if you're intellectually curious and you hustle, I mean, it doesn't even matter when we make a mistake, because when we make a mistake, successful man fall down seven times, get up eight. I mean, if I make a mistake, big deal. It's like I learn. Some lessons I learned by paying tuition, other lessons I learned because I stuck my tongue in the light socket myself. But if you learn from every failure, I mean, it's a good lesson.
Cool. Howard, you know, I appreciate you taking the time to sit and chat with me and everything. As we kind of sound off here, I haven't gotten an update from you for a while, because I know you're not podcasting as much, but I hesitate to ask how the retirement life is treating you, because I know you're a busy guy, but you know, what kind of things are you up to? And I guess, what kind of things are you up to? What can we expect from you in the future? And then if somebody wants to reach out, you know, kind of Dental Town, just give your kind of final shout out there as we wrap up here.
Well, I'll tell you what, my contact information is howard@dentaltown.com. Ever since I retired, I don't know how I worked before. My mom is, she's 85, so she's starting to have memory issues, and that's taking some time. And it's nice to be able to go visit your mom on Thanksgiving, but can stay a month, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I had another boy. His wife had an emergency operation, and she had four kids. And my son's working all day, and so Grandpa got to go there and be the mom for 6 weeks. And then that happened to another kid. His wife got sick for a couple months, and so between the mom and four kids and daughter-in-laws and eight grandchildren, I mean, I'm just having the time. I just love the fact that, you know, they'll call me in Beeville and they'll say, Grandpa, is there any way? And it's like, dude, I'm walking to my car now. I'll be there in 12 hours. And that's just, awesome. You know, yeah. And then your mom calls you up and says, Howie, next time, when are you coming back? And I was like, Mom, I'm walking to the car now. I mean, I got a little bag, and I just love it, man. It's just, But you know, taking the grandkids fishing, you know, you go over and show up at a grandkid's house at 3 o'clock, and you got some Dunkin' Donuts and a chocolate milk and two Mickey Mouse fishing poles. And I'm all organized. I got it in the Tupperware, the containers from Walmart. And, you know, I can decide we're going fishing, throw the tub in the back of the truck, and we're all fishing. And oh my God, I just,
that's amazing. I've got a 11-week-old at home right now. It's our first one. And And it's by far the hardest thing ever is juggling, like being a full-time practice owner. I still do pretty much everything myself. And then I basically go to work, I see a bajillion kids and fix all their problems and cavities. Then I come home and I've got this crying baby and I'm up all night. And it's just this big whirlwind of like, you know, but it gives me some skin in the game as a pediatric dentist to have a kid of my own. So now when parents talk to me, I can be like, no, we went through the nursing thing and now, you know, the kid wants juice. So I have some skin in the game. So the dad life is a good life. And I'm sure the grandpa life is a good life for sure.
Well, the only advice I'll give you on the parenting life, and I'll never budge on this advice. You have two kids 18 months apart. They're never looking for mom or dad. You have one kid all alone and they're only looking for you. And then you have like 4 years apart or 5 years apart, and then they quite don't get along. But they call them Irish twins. But when you have them, I had four boys in 60 months. And my ex and I used to always say that we felt like we could leave, go out to dinner, come back, see a movie and come back, because they were just a tornado of activity. And they never can. just remember, you got the second one has got to be right on top of the first one. And then your life is easy peasy.
Cool. Yeah. I'll make sure that we'll just go ahead and start pumping them out. I'll tell Jenna that when I get home tonight. That's good advice.
Yeah,
that a boy. Well, Howard, man, it was a pleasure, and I appreciate you taking the time to chat with me. And if I'm ever in Phoenix, I'm going to hit you up, and we'll do this beer in person sometime.
Absolutely, man. It was an honor. If you ever want to do it again, I'd be game. Thanks for all that you do for the industry.
Appreciate it, Howard. Have a good one. We'll see you.
All right, man.
All right, see you.
Thanks for listening to the Brews and Tiny Teeth podcast. Be sure to DM our host, Casey Getz, on social media with any listener questions, comments, or tough clinical situations. We'll see you next week for another unfiltered episode.